Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
So what is the truth about our animal friends? If we propose that many of them feel emotions, experience joy and sorrow, pain and pleasure, and have a fairly active grasp on the world around them, then what does this mean for our world as we hear of mass extinctions, the destruction of whole ecosystems, and increasing experimentation? We continue this journey of discovery when the voice of the Earth returns here on the Wildside News. If animals have a developed experiential awareness of their world, then what does this mean for us in this current age of radical changes in the natural world? We continue our conversation with distinguished animal behaviorist Dr. Mark Beckhoff. Let's expand this out as well. Beyond play, this has led as well to many other explorations on your part in terms of other emotions that dogs and other creatures have.
Right. Another thing I did that was really fun, because I love doing hands-on work, was a lot, you know, many people think that dogs and wolves and coyotes, for example, they scent mark to mark their territory. Once again, if, you know, Fido pees somewhere and another animal comes, they'll sniff it and avoid the area. Or, you know, whether or not these animals recognize their own odor. But no one had ever done a real detailed study of this, especially like for free-ranging animals. So over 5 winters, I would follow my dog Jethro, and every time he peed, I would pick up the yellow snow, and I would move it from place to place, and then I would pick up the yellow snow from other dogs and move it to place, just to see what Jethro and these other dogs would do to their own and others' urine.
This changes the whole game.
Yeah, it does change the whole game. And in the literature in animal behavior, people have studied self-recognition, or what I call self-cognizance, in animals, and concentrating primarily on the great apes. And they use mirrors, and they come up with different experiments, the results of which, you know, they conclude, well, these animals either do or don't recognize themselves in a mirror. But, you know, dogs are visual, but they also have very strong smell, senses of smell.
Yeah.
So no one did this. And what, in a nutshell, what we found was that the dogs do discriminate their urine and their yellow snow from that of others. And once again, while people have intuited it, you know, the details of the study are really interesting, so it's not a straightforward as some people think. But, you know, basically, that's another study we did. And, you know, so Jethro, for example, my dog, could say, well, that's my urine. It's not another animal's urine. And it depended on, you know, gender, how long the animal, how long before the animal had peed, and stuff like that. So it was, I mean, you know, once again, these are very basic questions. And what I love about them is that they really give you a lot of information of what's going on in the head, and, you know, in terms of emotions, what's going on in the heart of these animals.
Mm-hmm. As a scientist, your premise is that these animals do have much more complex and involved emotional content in their being. Let's start to investigate some of the other emotions that you are prepared to discuss in terms of animals. For example, grief, empathy, compassion, loyalty. You really have worked out a lot of this in terms of putting this together in terms of what this ultimately means in the animals, and then as well what that means for us in terms of our relationship with these beings. Yes.
Right. I mean, so for example, you know, empathy and compassion are important in play. It's important that I be able to place myself in your paws, if you will, when we play, so that I know what you're feeling, and likewise you have to do the same so that you know what I'm feeling. But There's also compassion. There's many studies in many species, but like in elephants, where one individual clearly understands that another individual's leg is injured, for example, and they'll touch it with their trunk and they'll try to soothe them. Grief. It's just very clear that many animals grieve over the loss of friends. They change their whole demeanor changes. They walk differently. They vocalize differently. They search out their friends who are missing, for example. So there's grief, anger, fear. There's some very good examples of, you know, jealousy, where one animal tries to insert him or herself into an ongoing social interaction because they want to be part of the scene.
It certainly happens all the time with dogs.
Oh,
if you have a number
time.
Of dogs.
Let's go to a dog park.
Yeah, exactly.
Just spend a couple of hours watching animals at a dog park, and you'll have a really good handle on what's going on in their heads and in their hearts.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's many, many other there's many emotions other than just, you know, joy, for example.
Here's a fun question for you. So
Sorry?
let's talk about you've studied many different animals. You've really focused on dogs, but since you've really focused on dogs, I think it might be interesting for you to give us a sense of what it means to be dog. What is it that motivates them? What are they about humans? There's many different things that humans are different than dogs. But what would you say is the nature of the dog?
Well, you know, sometimes I think I can give an easy answer to that, and sometimes I think it's really one of the hardest questions in the world. But, you know, basically, most individual dogs are social beings. They like being with other individuals, whether a dog, a human, a cat, or some other animal being. They have very keen senses of smell. They can hear very well. So their world is very much, if you will, dominated by odors and by sounds. They see well enough, but, you know, they don't have great vision. So I think that a lot of what motivates a dog during a given day is to sniff out friends, to hang out and play, or just to hang out. Just the mere company of other animals is very soothing. As we know, if you've lived with a dog, they don't have to play with you all day. They just need to know that you're there. So I think that basically, you know, capsules it. I don't like, some people think that they're unconditional lovers. And while I think they do give love quite freely, I don't think they're so unconditional. I mean, my dogs have always discriminated among individuals, and there were some they just didn't like. So I think that a lot of people just say, well, dogs love everyone and they'll do anything for anyone. And I don't think that that's quite the case.
Oh, I think it's very specific to individuals.
Mm-hmm.
The bonding is very, it's like they spiritually mate or something like that with their master or their family. And that's very important, as it would be in, for example, a pack.
Oh, yeah. I mean, right. In a pack, you just can't show, you just don't form social bonds that are as tight as, you know, between, say, a mated pair. Those are very tight social bonds. So you sort of form stronger or weaker social bonds. And it's that, once again, it's those shades of gray that keep the pack together that help foster the integrity of the pack. You know, mm-hmm. Some animals are just going to feel closer to others, and it's no different than in human groups.
Well, now, here's a question that a lot of people argue about. Do you think that these animals think?
Oh, I know they think. I mean, there are very few people who ask that question anymore.
I'm happy about that, but I just thought I'd let you take a stab at it.
Yeah, I mean, I just think, once again, you know, it's a no-brainer in terms of, do animals, or most animals, have the capacity to think? You know, we're not just all reflex. But of course, a lot of what other animals do is reflex-like. Just like a lot of what we do is reflex-like.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, many, many individuals and many species have to make decisions when habitat is changing, food supply is changing, the nature, the composition of their social groups change. So, you know, wolves have to, individual wolves have to make assessments of who's in their pack and what they're likely to do in a certain situation. So it can't just all be hardwired. And I've done a lot of work with birds that show that birds have a very good feeling for how many other birds are around, and they base their behavior on what they can see. So, for example, in evening grosbeaks, or western evening grosbeaks, if you have a group of animals, they will look around and make decisions that, well, if enough animals are feeding with their head down, then I should be looking up, being vigilant for predators.
Uh-huh.
And vice versa, if there's a lot of animals just looking up, then that tells me it's safe for me to feed.
Oh, so there's a social compact between these creatures, some eating, some taking responsibility to watch.
Well, the relationship is strong enough that you could make that inference. I don't know that, but yeah,
right,
it looks
right.
like they're just agreeing that, you know, in a certain amount of time, each of us will have enough time to feed, and each of us will also have to pay the dues looking out for predators. Right. That's how coordinated it is.
Yeah. So
right.
if
and so are they thinking about it? Well, I think they're thinking about it, because if you change the individuals or you change the geometry of the group so that they're in a straight line rather than a circle, their behavior changes.
Mm.
So the most parsimonious explanation, of course, would be that not everything they do is hardwired.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's room for learning, and there's room for basically making on-the-spot decisions to do something.
Well, you and I agree that it's way more involved. And so let's go there a little bit. So if these animals can think, and I perfect agreement they do, they reason, they figure things out. They animals, quite honestly, you take a dog and you put them into complex situations, they have incredible capacities to work their way out of these situations in amazing ways, that it's not based on reflex or anything. They think things out. They look at things. They analyze things. So they are doing that. And then, of course, so I'm, to get back to the point, so if they can think, and they do, and as well they have a variety of emotions, and they have friends, and they have enemies, and they have to survive. We're talking about a very complex, a really truly complex reality for these animals. It isn't just sort of walking around. I don't know what it is that some people think, that they sort of walk through life, and if they see a bird, they chase the bird, and if they don't catch the bird, they look for another bird or a ground squirrel. It sounds as if it's much more complex than that.
Oh, yeah, a lot of people, once again, you know, these days it's hard to find people taking this view, but some people used to describe animals as sleepwalkers.
Yeah.
You know, they basically walk through life, and they don't pay attention to many things, and much of their behavior is pre-programmed, and, you know, they're not particularly complex beings, but very few people take that view anymore. I mean, most people accept right off the bat that we have discovered that animals have very complex social and emotional lives. They can make very complex decisions very rapidly. They can assess a situation and make the correct choice of behaviors, if you will, very rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
And so times are really changing.
Mm-hmm.
There's just not many people anymore who carte blanche say that animals are, you know, automatons, like robots.
So then the next question is, then, how does this begin to affect our relationship in our society with these creatures that we do many things with and to? For example, we raise them for labor. We keep them as pets. We raise them so that we can skin them for pelts. We eat them. How does that affect us? How does that really matter?
That's probably the biggest and most important question. I think that what it does is, realizing these animals are smart, but more especially what they feel. I always say what animals feel is much more important than what they know in terms of how we treat them, because there's great individual differences among humans. So, you know, if you said, well, if you can play chess, or if you can play Bach, or, you know, even if you could run a 100-yard dash in under 12 seconds, then you'll get some privileged treatment. So, you know, we have those variations in many animals. But really what it is, it's what they feel. And very slowly and very steadily, more and more people are becoming more upset about how we interact with other animals. And so the bottom line, and that in an applied way, is that we can use this knowledge to make the lives of other animals much better.
So when we think about animals in our world, here in the good old U.S. of A., there's a lot going on. We're finding many communities, animal communities, being diminished through development or forestry or various practices, resources, extraction. And so therefore, if based on what we've talked about, these animals are feeling and sensing changes in their environment. How do you think this is affecting them in reality?
Well, I think they all have a point of view. I think that social animals don't like to have their families broken up, just like we don't like to have our families broken up. They don't like being moved around as if they're, you know, a couch or a chair. Developers do that. Zoos do it. When they have a problem with an animal, they move the animal. So just this past week at the Brookfield Zoo in Illinois, a wolf was severely attacked by a bunch of wolves. And as far as I can see, the zoo was remiss in not monitoring the situation more closely. And so they separated the animals. The attacked animal will survive. And then they say, and now we'll move that animal to another zoo or another enclosure so that he won't get attacked. But that's not the answer. I mean, how would we like it if we were told, well, every time something happens, we'll just move you around.
Mm-hmm.
So my take is that they have a worldview, they have a perspective, they have a point of view, and they don't like it when they are injured, they don't like it when their families are broken up, they don't like it when they're moved from one spot to another in order to satisfy our innate, almost an incessant drive to expand our borders.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know, more and more people now are not accepting that type of treatment, and they're fighting it. You know, they're saying animals aren't like dressers, and they're not like couches, and we just can't move them at will to satisfy our needs and wants.
Having this type of perspective adds an incredible richness to life in reality, because when one embraces this and they take a walk out in your neighborhood or in the forest or out into the wilderness, you begin to realize that there's a lot of community. There's a lot of interaction and awareness within that whole community of animals, the elk and the badger and the raven and the hawk and the mouse and even the grasshopper and the squirrel. You know, they're communicating and aware and conscious of one another and have a sense of community that perhaps we haven't any idea of in reality.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I always say they talk to one another, you know, sort of metaphorically.
They do.
They can, quote, tell one another what's happening. Mm. And, you know, they basically take heed and will move out of a habitat, for example, that's been exploited. You know, deer, wolves know when there are a few deer. You know, they can kind of assess how hard it is that they have to, you know, work to catch a deer, or how far they have to travel to find a deer. So they know all this. So
now,
yeah,
you expand this work out actually around the world. You've worked with some extraordinary people, Jane Goodall, for example, and co-authored a book with her. And you also have a new book that's coming out. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, actually, my new book is called Animal Passions and Beastly Virtues: Reflections on Redecorating Nature. And it deals with what we've been talking about, animal passions being animal emotions, virtues being honor among beasts, honest communication, you know, during play, for example. And reflections on redecorating nature means, you know, moving animals from here to there, you know, as if they're couches. And we need to reflect on what is happening.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and we do. And so basically we need to be very careful. We need to tread lightly when we redecorate nature.
I've heard good things about the book, although I haven't read it yet, but I'm hearing people who are familiar with it. And they say that it's a wonderful combination of both sort of the human perspective, as we've been talking about, and the scientific research to back it up, to integrate both, which is really, there's almost like a new science that's emerging, and I'm excited about that.
Yes. Yeah, there's a science of compassion. What's really exciting to me is that, you know, so many students are really embracing it. So many students are just really, really excited about having respectful science, compassionate science, science with a heart, as I call it.
Well, you know what? You're lucky to be in that realm right now.
I am really lucky.
Yeah. Because I imagine it's been kind of a lonely path getting to this point, hasn't it?
Yeah. In many ways, I often felt like that first penguin jumping into the water when there were predators. But once again, Mike Fox and Jane Goodall and Roger Fouts and Tom Reagan and Peter Singer and just Dale Jameson, a lot of people who are my friends and I've worked with, you just keep working steadily. You never give up. That's what I tell students, that there's always hope. You gotta be an optimist. You've gotta be one of those people who look at the glass as being half full rather than half empty. I'm often told that I'm a glass full guy. There's a lot of really not good things happening in the world, but there's a lot of really good things happening in the world. And so, you know, I just love the idea that we really are making progress against all odds.
Well, I think one of the greatest things that's happening is the work that you're doing, because it's opening up what I believe is the true reality about life on this planet Earth and its miraculousness as a gift to us. And we have a lot more that we can gain in terms of our sense of splendor and joy once we become attuned to that wonder, as you have and as you so well express.
Yeah, well, thanks. I mean, I consider it a gift to be able to do the things that we're doing. I mean, I really do. I mean, I consider, you know, very strongly what you're doing to be, you know, a very fortunate activity. There's so much to learn about other animals. There's so much to appreciate. And when we understand them, then we're going to really appreciate them. And there always will be some resistance, but I'll tell you, the resistance is really going down by the day. More and more people are just tired of what we're doing to Earth and to other animals.
Right on there, boy. Dr. Mark Burkhoff, Mark, I want to thank you so much for sharing your thoughts. We're out of time, so I'm going to have to let you go, but we're going to do this again. We're going to continue talking about these things, and I'd like to have you invite your friends as well, some of the students you're working with, and let's carry on this conversation into the future.
I would love it. Thank you. This is just really very important.
Great. Thanks a lot, Mark.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Perhaps this will help us all open our eyes wide to a whole new sense of our Earth, and quite literally, lead to a greater sense of Eden. When we return, it's out to the beautiful state of Hawaii to check on the current status of an ongoing eruption when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.